down to brass tacks. Hello.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ellis, and your guest.
Good morning still.
Sorry, morning. Can your guest explain to the public about rivers how the country that you just spoke so highly about, how they use the national insurance fund?
Well, what Singapore does, well, it's a very similar system to what we have in Barbados, but they also have an additional protections for health insurance, and they have a housing fund as well that persons contribute to on a out of their wages.
I don't think that's where he wants you to go. He wants you to speak about how they invest the funds, because that's the special area that he... Is that the rain falling by you, Mr. Kelman?
No, the rain is not falling by me, too.
Well, because it's quite noisy. Yeah.
No, but what they do, I mean, the issues of transparency and accountability are significant. And what they have been able to do, the country, is to establish very robust institutions. They have a sovereign wealth fund, which is one of the largest and most respected globally, that they have used to safeguard the interests of the country.
Do you agree with them that is a good idea for them to use the funds to bail out the country, so that by bailing out the country, they protect the contributions? Because as you would appreciate, that once you create investment and not savings, that there's a possibility that you will save jobs or you will create jobs, which will increase the contributions of the fund?
Yes, I was saying to somebody that the government of Singapore is this provider of housing for over 80% of the population. The country, each person is required to contribute to a housing fund. That housing fund is used to create, to provide a deposit for individuals to buy a home, which is built by the same housing authority which issues the mortgages. So the government is both the contractor, builder, and mortgager to the individuals. All of the benefits derived from both of the construction and from the financing, therefore, goes back to the housing fund. And it has allowed that fund to grow year on year and to become a major resource for the provision of public housing. And the point that the government of Singapore makes is that it is not a welfare state. Anything that it is providing to its people has to be done in an economically sustainable manner.
Mr. Kelman?
Yes, please.
No. If we accept that in principle, that you want to invest NIS funds, over the last 10 years, where have these NIS funds been invested in Barbados? And what is the result? What do we have to show for it?
I'm very glad you asked that, because, you see, whenever government borrows from the National Insurance Fund, they borrow to save jobs or create jobs. And every employee pays contributions. And we focus too much on the interest rate that the national insurance is receiving. National insurance should never be set up just to focus on interest rates. What they should be set up to focus on, increasing contributions. And that is why they continue to make the mistake, because instead of getting involved in investment, they get involved in savings, which means that they only get one return. Whereas when they get involved in investment, they get the investment on the loan length, the loan length, and they also...
What are the results in Barbados? What do we have to show for the investment that you spoke about?
Because, as I said, let me explain to you, sir. And I understand where you're coming from, sir. Don't think that I will be hostile to you. And sometimes you put your questions as if you're being hostile, but I know you're not being hostile. Because you know that I can answer you. The truth is that when government, for example, when National Insurance lends government money, the government has to pay. And by the way, they were paying them at a premium. On top of that, that money went to keep civil servants in work. And by civil servants being in work, those civil servants were contributing to the National Insurance Fund by the means of contribution. So they were not only getting the interest from government, but they were also safeguarding their contributions. And that's why over the years...
Is it not true that the government owes national insurance because it was not paying those contributions?
But even if that is true...
Is it true or is it not true?
But I am not even going to get involved in that nitty-gritty.
You began by saying that the plus to it all is that they were paid and they were making contributions. But if those contributions were not going into back to NIS, as you allege, then where's the benefit?
The benefit is that you and I will have to pay something at some point in time.
The truth of the matter is that you were saying that the NIS money went into pay wages, and because the government was not making its contribution to the NIS, it was effectively depleting the resources of the NIS.
You know why you would make that point, David? Because you are still tied up in deficit financing, whereas I have recognized that we have to move on, and I look at it from a profit and loss point of view. But because you are caught up in a deficit financing, you're looking at the cash flow. But I'm not looking at cash flow because...
I'm looking at the investment.
But Comrade Kelman, if I could say as well, I mean, one, the National Insurance Scheme was not really, it was not designed to be the lender of last resort to the government. That's the first thing. The second thing is, the second point is, and I respect where you're coming from. The second point is, though, where a national insurance scheme is making investments, prudence dictates that should be low risk. Should be low risk. And we know that while on paper, governments should be a low-risk investment. Overexposure to any one entity is dangerous. And this is just the point that I think, or part of the discussion that I am just hearing, that yes, the national insurance has a responsibility to look at growth, but it should look at growth in a prudent and a low-risk manner. And if it... Yes.
Can I ask a favor? What you said sounds very good. But you know the what I'm going to say to that. That if National Insurance was investing and not saving, then government will have no need to owe the National Insurance anything. Because National Insurance would have been using the funds wisely, expanding the economy, and the government would not necessarily have to get involved. We have to stop seeing all National Insurance funds as a national insurance fund of savings, where they put the money in the bank, because they do not create contributions when the money is in the bank. When they go and invest in real investment, that is where they create employment and they create contributions to sustainability.
But you haven't given us the real investments that they put the money in. You said you put the money in jobs. You didn't tell me about any real investment. Where's the real investment?
I'm about to do that. And you see, that is why I was happy that Comrade Hewitt made the point. Because what government is doing, a broke government is doing, a wealthy national insurance should have been doing. And you'll agree with me that what has happened over the last 10 years or so, that national insurance became rich at the expense, from a balance sheet point of view, at the expense of government, because government was forced to do things that national insurance should have been doing. Because, as I said already, that what y'all are not focusing on is the opportunity cost of using money. And whenever national insurance is in savings, it is not using the best opportunity cost of those funds. And that is why national insurance needs to understand that in renewable energy, they should have been heavily investing in that. In the hotel industry, they should have been heavily investing in that, instead of just taking the money and putting it in the banking system. Because whenever they do that and they expand the economy, they're also expanding their contribution, because their survival is not on investment, or interest. It is really on contributions. And National Insurance Fund is set up to increase contributions.
You know what should happen, Mr. Kelman?
Yes, please.
If you have an agency like National Insurance, and you have specialists who are asked to assess risks, and those people, in their good judgment, determine.
You mean outdated judgment?
No, this is, you know, there's something terribly wrong with a system that you employ people to do a particular job. They give you the best advice that they can, and you have people, other people who are not as well informed as they are, who will come and make decisions that will ultimately impair the very organization that you are talking about and the future livelihood of other people. This system needs to be protected from that kind of cavalier behavior. You know, this is something that is at the core of what may be seen as wrong in Barbados today. Politicians who, for their own reasons, ignore professional advice and go on their own frolic.
I'm glad you made that point, because maybe the reverse is true. And I'm happy, I must tell you, I'm happy that chairman of the National Insurance is the person that has been named, because I hope that he has a wider vision of where National Insurance will go and the understanding of where the National Insurance should be increasing contributions, and do not every minute, once they want to increase their revenue, add to the rate. And instead of dealing with the rate, deal with the expansion of job creation. Because sooner or later, there will be nobody to pay the contribution. If National Insurance does not change the policy that you are so wisely defending. Hello?
I'm just listening to you. I just think
clearly
the divide is over the investment policy. Would you concede, Mr. Kelman, because you've blasted the former National Insurance Administration and stuff in this conversation, would you concede that there was a strong divergence of opinion over how the resources of the National Insurance Fund should have been invested? And that you as a politician, ran against the kind of advice that you were getting from within the NIS, that you should not have been tying up so much of the resources in protecting government jobs.
You see, unlike you, maybe some of the other people who defend that policy, my training has taught me to look at the opportunity cost. Everything I do, I look at the opportunity cost of it. And you see, I just explained to you something, and you're going back to the same page. National Insurance needs to move away from savings, and it needs to move towards investment. And there's a big difference between savings and investment, which I explained to you earlier. But obviously,
NIS was investing locally and outside of Barbados as well.
All right. You see, you keep mixing up savings and investment.
All right, sir.
And I've said to you that whenever they get involved in investment,
as Minister of Housing, offer them something? The Reverend Hewitt just spoke about the housing fund in Singapore.
You do not know why I offer them.
But I want to hear now, then. Minister
of Housing.
Were you offered?
Hello?
What did you offer? I'm listening.
When I left as Minister of Housing, there was a proposal from National Insurance that I was quite prepared to entertain and deal with. Only thing that there are some people who believe that the National Insurance is the only entity that understands the value of things. And they felt that because I was running an organization that might have been cash broke, that I should have accepted little or nothing in return for prime real estate.
There were no maybes about its cash position. It was broke.
Exactly. And that is why you could not give real prime real estate at the time. And you have to
A counter proposal. What was your counter proposal?
That is not the calling program.
What? what is not for the calling program? You were paid by the taxpayers of Barbados to advance ideas on their behalf.
You know why I like you?
Why?
You know how to make money for VLB. But if you want to make money off me for VLB, you don't have to help
me. But you call me. I didn't call you. Well, you don't understand how you could come up with that accusation. Anyhow, thank you very much for your contribution. Down to brass tacks. Another major story in the news is that Barbados suffered another credit rating downgrade. But Standard & Poor's is saying that once the country completes its domestic and foreign debt exchanges, the rating is expected to improve. One official of Standard & Poor's is quoted as saying that at that time, we will analyze the sovereign's general credit standing, most likely raising the issuer credit rating to CCC or low B categories. So this is a negative, and there is a positive in that. Down to brass tacks.
Hello, good afternoon.
Yes, welcome.
Yes, good afternoon, Mrs. Ellis. I've been calling this program for a long, long time. Right, I am calling to warn the customers of
specific problem.
I'm going to right now. Okay, a gentleman came at my house. I think it was late 2016 or early 2017, and he asked me if I have internet. I said yes, I have internet, but it's working slow. He said okay. He said he could give me an upgrade, and then he told me that he asked me if I had Lime TV. I said no. He said, okay, you can pay an extra $17 or $19 and get Lime TV. I said, okay. And the whole thing come to $160. Okay, I agree. He told me to initial here and sign there. I signed there, okay? After I leave the place I was living, so I went to the office and told them that I wanted to disconnect the service from that address. They told me that I got a bundle, and if I want to disconnect it, I have to pay $195. I said, excuse me, when the gentleman came and spoke to me at my house, there were no discussion about a bundle. So when you're telling me the bundle is, I never heard that name of a bundle before. There was no discussion about a two-year contract, and there were no discussion that I have to pay any money if I disconnect the service before 2 years. So that's news to me. Anyway, she told me they have to pay $195, and I left. Then two months or so after, I got a bill from them saying that I have to pay them $595. I said to myself, I can see that this is going to be a court case because they have to take me to court first. So I got a letter from them yesterday telling me that I have to pay them the money or else they're going to take me to court and they're going to carry my name to the credit bureau so I won't get no credit. I don't care what Lime wants to do. I am not the only person. I'm sure that those people have done it too. And people need to be aware of Lime.
I think what is required here is that the company ideally should investigate your claim that what was represented to you as the service that was going to be provided was made completely clear to you, and that there was no dispute over what happened there.
I'm not the only person. I saw a gentleman.
Let's not deal with anybody else. Let's deal with your particular case here and now. It is not in the best interest of the company or in your best interest to have this kind of conflict over what was put to you in the first place. It is quite possible that there could be a misunderstanding about what was put to you, or that there could have been misrepresentation. It is quite possible one way or the other. So I think that it is unfortunate that it has reached the point where there's a discussion now about going to court. I think you may require, ideally what you want to do is try to resolve this without having to involve legal representatives or anything like that. Have you written to them? Because you went to a meeting.
I called the debt collector this morning. They told me that I would have to go to the office, but I drank something this morning, so I can't leave home today or tomorrow. So, and you can't even get to call the office, Mr. Ellis. You have to call overseas and speak to people who don't even understand.
Hold on. Well, somewhere along the line, you're going to have to make a determined effort to make contact with them to say that next week you need to get to a meeting where you can explore this. I think they will also, they need to hear from the representative. Whatever happened though, you said that you were told to sign. Did you read what you were asked to sign?
We had a full other discussion, you know.
You had a discussion.
I didn't know that
there
was something to read. I just initial
and sign. No. He gave you something to sign.
Yes.
As long as he gave you something to sign, you had something to read. So this is where the problem arose. You can't just go. You went on the basis of what.
But the fellow didn't know if I could read or not. So he was supposed to explain what was on the paper.
No. It doesn't work like that. You can't come now and claim that the person misrepresented the whole idea to you because you were asked to sign something and you didn't read it. I mean, a person can come and talk to you and tell you X and tell you Y, but they may miss something, not because they set out to mislead you, but because it might have slipped them. And that is why the mistake in all of this was that you signed a document without reading exactly what was on the paper. So now you find yourself into a contractual situation that is going to be very different. I'll just talk about court and that sort of thing. Once you sign the contract, you're in trouble. And you need to try to, you know, extricate yourself from this kind of contractual obligation. No. By having the discussion with them, you may very well end up having to pay them anyhow because that's what you signed on to. But you will have to say to them, look, this isn't exactly what I wanted. Unfortunately, you didn't read it. Okay? Sorry to hear about it, but it seems to me that's the crux of the issue. Down to brass tacks. Hello? You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, welcome.
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Ms. Ellis?
Hi.
Oh, yeah, just before the regional news, there was a conversation concerning national insurance.
Yes, with Mr. Kelman.
And I want to have a little say on it.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I don't like the word scheme. I don't like the word national insurance scheme. The word scheme. Because scheme reminds me of Ponzi, and I always associate Ponzi with fraud. But that's just by the way. What I really wanted to weigh in on was the self-employed person. Now, I saw a recent report in the paper where it stated that according to the 2010 national census, there were approximately 20,000 people employed, self-employed. But as at March 2018, there were only just over 2,000 people contributed to the National Insurance Fund. Now, that,
2,000?
That is 2,000.
Where is that report?
This was in the Nation, and it was...
What did?
I don't have the paper in front of me, but it was certainly a statement made by the Honorable Colin Jordan, who is the minister responsible for national insurance. And he was saying, in fact, that a lot of the lawyers and doctors and other self-employed people were not contributing. And the point that I wish to make here is that those approximately 18,000 people would comprise masons, carpenters, tailors, plumbers, and these are the people who, within the next three generations, having not contributed, will probably claim and get a non-contributory pension. And it is my opinion that the compliance department of the National Insurance Service should be going after those people now to get them to comply.
There's a story that was published, I think it was a couple of weeks ago. And what I'm seeing here is that Colin Jordan said that all persons who are employed and self-employed should ensure that they participate in the NIS. For some time now, it has been understood that several self-employed persons do not always pay NIS contributions. Pointing out that as of March 2018, there were approximately 2,035 self-employed persons submitting payments to the NIS. Jordan said in the last census done in 2010, the Barbados Statistical Service estimated there were 20,000 self-employed persons in Barbados.
Correct.
That is what the 2,000 figure is about, self-employed. Okay? Because 2,000 out of the total number of people employed in Barbados would certainly be way too low. Okay?
No, no. This is the 2,000 would be out of the 20,000 self-employed persons.
That's correct.
That's the impression I got. So what I'm saying is this here. If it is mandatory for self-employed persons to pay their contributions, register with national insurance and pay their contributions, then there is a big gap which should be sought out. The Compliance Department of the National Insurance Service, and I don't use the word scheme, the Compliance Department should, in fact, be going after those people in the first instance by persuasion. And perhaps if there is any law that demands that you register and pay contributions, then you go there. That will do a lot for the benefit of the National Insurance Service. And that, the other point that was made really and truly was the investment by the National Insurance of the funds. I mean, even if you had to get, okay, let's say there's a divide of 18,000 people at $20, $21 per week that you're not collecting. Even if you collected 75% of that, you have a large amount of money, huge amount of money, which you can invest. And what I would suggest also to the National Insurance Investment Department is that they take some of the contributions that they receive. Do the math and you'll see. Take some of the contributions that they receive and put it in a fund which I would choose to call a National Catastrophe Fund. And you invest that money. You don't invest money by putting it in the bank. You don't get money like that. You have to have investment that will create money, create wealth.
So how would a catastrophe fund create wealth?
No, no. The catastrophe fund, right, is a fund that you're investing that fund. And if you do not have a catastrophe, let us say in 5 years, right, then that fund will grow. And it makes Barbados less reliant on international donors or begging people for money. You know, like how Dominica had a problem this year. It had a problem 2 years ago. They don't have a catastrophe fund. Barbados could be in the same position this year because we're still in the hurricane season.
Any thoughts on what he suggested, Reverend Hewitt?
Well, when I was in the UK and the hurricane hit, particularly Dominica, one of the things we were discussing, and it was not just at the national level, because the severity of a major storm wipes out most resources, including any fund that you try to accumulate, that the countries in the Commonwealth come together and to establish a mechanism which could include financial resources to provide support to countries that are imperiled. I agree that we have to prepare for what some would say is the inevitable of a major storm again affecting Barbados. But I think what we are doing in the region, coming together and creating a risk insurance facility, not just for one country, but for the region, has been the prudent way forward. And as I said, I have been trying to encourage at the wider international Commonwealth level, we find ways of supporting ourselves and each other.
Yes, I agree with that. That's a brilliant idea. But it's just really an extension of what insurance is all about.
Correct.
you see, if you can help yourself immediately after a catastrophe, that goes a long way. And instead of waiting for people to help you, to send help to you, you must be able to help yourself to a certain extent. But you see, this is a long-term investment that I'm thinking of. This is something to make Barbados really and truly independent. And the National Insurance Service should spearhead the development. I can see the National Insurance Service, for example, responding to the agricultural sector to reduce the $800 million of imports that we have every year, reducing it to a reasonable level and encouraging the production of food fruits, vegetables, etc., within Barbados. Not necessarily for export, but to reduce the cost to Barbados. At the same time, we create employment, giving people opportunities.
But if I can respond to this, because this is the point, again, that was made earlier. I think we are confusing a national insurance fund with a national development fund. We're talking about how do we stimulate the economy, how do we do job creation. And while I agree that these are essential tasks, especially now as we are struggling to come out of a recession and dealing with austerity, I don't know that it is the role of national insurance. And I would not, for me as a contributor, want the national insurance in the first instance to be putting its money into what would be high-risk ventures. Because activities, economic activities, construction activities, developmental activities, have a level of risk that I feel for a fund that is supposed to be safeguarding my welfare at retirement or when I fall ill or have maybe disabled in some way or medically unfit. I would not want that money to be put at risk through investments that can't be guaranteed.
Let me share something with you from the last actuarial review, the 15th yeah. one. It said, as at December 2014, total NIF, that's National Insurance Fund reserves, were $4.7 billion.
Yeah.
8.0 times expenditure in 2014. Outstanding contributions, total $224 million. After yeah. falling behind on its contributions and rental payments, the government of Barbados covered some of its arrears by issuing treasury notes and debentures to the NIF. Now, the question is, there was a time when we didn't consider those to be high risk, but they are now.
True.
And the question is, after this, where is the NIS going to invest its money, given the concerns that are now being raised about treasury notes, treasury bills, and debentures? Where is it going to turn to give you that assurance?
Brother Ellis, there was a time when you could say what goes up must come down. That is no longer true.
It isn't true.
I think it is quite true.
The rates that people were getting before, which were high, are certainly down now.
What I was thinking of, you can set up a satellite and it doesn't come down.
One of the options is to say, look, you are going to look at certain of the state-owned enterprises and you're going to create a system where average people are going to be able to put some of their money in it, and NIS could perhaps be seen in that light. But central to all of that, though, is the efficient operation of them. So let's take all of these agricultural bodies that we got, the statutory corporations, BAMC, BADMC, and all of these entities that have been calling for government input on a regular basis or too regular a basis. It is one thing to conceptualize that you're going to divest, but then what is that structure that you're going to put in place to ensure that there is indeed a return on investment?
That is the most important thing, the return on investment. Now, having said all of that, let me just say this. Whenever there is, according to the actuarial reports, etc., whenever there is likely to be a shortfall of the revenue, what do you do? There are two things you do. One, you increase the rates. Ridiculous. Two, you increase the pensionable age. What I'm suggesting basically is that if you have a good investment department, which invests not only in local high risk, there's no longer, you can't say the low risk again, government paper, because certainly the current situation is that it cannot be classified as low risk. It has to be high risk now. What I'm saying to you is this. We have to go outside of Barbados and invest. We must have that authority. If it, If the National Insurance Service does not have that authority, no, it should have that authority. And that is how you create wealth, growth, by investing. And you don't invest in one government paper and set up buildings for government to rent and then don't pay the rent. And then, worst of all, government take the money from the National Insurance Fund and pay millions in salaries. It is totally ridiculous.
Well,
it is a clear case for self-destruction.
You know, you have some serious questions to resolve here. Now, in this same review, it says, looking towards the future, the total expenditure will exceed contribution income each year. Total expenditure will first exceed total income between 2028 and 2045. The fund will be depleted as early as 2045 under the pessimistic scenario, or as late as 2074 under the optimistic scenario. The pay-as-you-go rate in 2074 will be between 27% and 37%. The average long-term cost of benefits over the next 60 years, often referred to as the general average premium, is between 24.0% and 28.4%. And then it says, these results are based on Barbados government debt being redeemed as scheduled at full face value. Should the government of Barbados restructure any debt held by the NIF through reducing the face amount and or yields on bonds, debentures, the outlook for the fund finances would be worse than presented above. If holdings of government of Barbados debt are excluded from the NIF, depletion of reserves is projected to occur in 2033. But we see what has happened. The debt has been restructured. So against that backdrop, the scenario confronting the NIS has changed, not so much for the better from what we see. Okay?
Yeah.
So the call for an interim actuarial review of the NIS to me seems to be quite valid. We're going to the Starcom Network News, and then we're going to come back with my guest, Reverend Guy Hewitt, to this edition of Down to Brass Stats.